Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, First Canto, Chapter 19, Text Number 8. Tatro pajagmor bhuvananam punana. Tatro pajagmor bhuvanam punana. Mahanubhava munaya sasishya. Mahanubhava munaya sasishya. Prayena tirtha bigama padeshai. Prayena tirtha bigama padeshai. Swayam hi tirthani punanti shanta. Swayam hi tirthani punanti santa. Tatro pajamor bhuvanam punana. Mahanubhava munaya sisasya. Prayena tirtha bigama padesha. Swayam hi tirthani punanti santa. Others, please. Tatro pajagmor bhuvanam punana. Vaishnavis.
Vaishnavis.
Tatra there. Upajagmu arrived. Bhuvanam the universe. Punana those who can sanctify. Maha Anubhava great minds. Munaya thinkers. Sasisya along with their disciples. Prayena almost. Tirtha place of pilgrimage. Abhigama journey. Apadeshai on the plea of. Swayam personally. He certainly. Tirthani all the places of pilgrimage. Punanti sanctify. Santa sages. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. At that time, all the great minds and thinkers, accompanied by their disciples and sages who could verily sanctify a place of pilgrimage just by their presence, arrived there on the plea of making a pilgrim's journey. Purport. When Maharaj Prickett sat down on the bank of the Ganges, the news spread in all directions of the universe, and the great-minded sages who could follow the importance of the occasion all arrived there on the plea of pilgrimage. Actually, they came to meet Maharaj Prickett and not to take a bath of pilgrimage because all of them were competent enough to sanctify the places of pilgrimage. Common men go to pilgrimage sites to get themselves purified of all sins. Thus, the places of pilgrimage become overburdened with the sins of others. But when such sages visit overburdened places of pilgrimage, they sanctify the places by their presence. Therefore, the sages who came to meet Maharaj Prickett were not very much interested in getting themselves purified like common men. But on the plea of taking a bath in that place, they came to meet Maharaj Prickett because they could foresee that Srimad Bhagavatam would be spoken by Sukadeva Goswami. All of them wanted to take advantage of the great occasion. Om Ganatam Adam Dasha Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshurna Molitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupakadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam. So Srila Prabhupada says here in the purport that all these great-minded sages, Maharaj Prickett, he sat down on the bank of the Ganges and news spread in all directions of the universe. So, how is that? How is that? The news spread in all directions of the universe. So, in my attempt to answer my question, I'll do it. There'll be two parts, a philosophical part, and I'll get into a technical part. So, in the philosophical part, the reason is why the news spread in all directions of the universe is because Krishna is pleased. Krishna was pleased by Maharaj Prickett, and therefore he makes it so that his devotee becomes glorified. I found a nice reference for this in the fourth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam in the chapter Dhruv Maharaj Returns Home. And there it's stated, I guess it's Narada Muni speaking, says, unto one who has transcendental qualities due to friendly behavior with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, all living entities offer honor, just as water automatically flows down by nature. See, so, Krishna makes it his business. If somebody's his pure devotee and they're glorifying him, and that's Krishna's reciprocation, he makes them famous without any endeavor on their part. An example that Prabhupada gives in the purport to that verse I just cited there, quoted, is the Srinivasacharya's prayers in glorification of the six Goswamis. The second prayer is Nana Shastra Vachada Naikini Panosa Dharma Samstapako Lokanam Hitakarino Tribhuvane Manyosa Ranyakarava. The six Goswamis, they were scrutinizingly studying all the revealed scriptures with the aim of establishing eternal religious principles for the benefit of all mankind. And here it comes. Thus, they are honored all over the three worlds. They're honored all over the three worlds. They didn't do anything to try to be honored all over the three worlds, but automatically, they're honored all over the three worlds because they're great devotees of Krishna. So that's just how it works. And in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 11, text 34, there's that verse where, 33, Krishna tells Arjuna, get up, prepare to fight. You know, and this way you'll enjoy a flourishing kingdom. They've already, all these soldiers have already been put to death by my arrangement. And then in the next verse, he names them Bhishma, Drona, this one, you know. And Prabhupada says in the purport that Krishna, he likes to give credit. That's the point. He likes to give credit to his devotees who carry out his plan according to his direction. See? So that's Krishna's reciprocation. So that's what I would say is the philosophical reason why this is happening, why all these sages are coming. You know, why the news spread in all directions all over the universe, and why these great-minded sages are coming to be present for this occasion. Because Krishna's pleased with Maharaj Brihadi. He's a pure devotee, and he's doing exactly what Krishna wants him to do in this situation, which is accept the curse, surrender, you know, prepare to leave his body. And so that's why it's happening. Now, the next part is the technical. How does it happen? How does it work? How do they find out about it? Because as is mentioned here, they're from all over the universe. And Amala Bhakti Maharaj asked this question back when we first started this subject, maybe a couple of weeks ago at the end of a class. And it was just briefly touched upon, but I'm going to try to elaborate upon that. Of course, one aspect to the answer would be, well, you know, Krishna is the super soul. Sarvasya chaham radisane vishto matak smrita gyanam apohanam chadat. Krishna's in everyone's heart, and from him comes knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. So there's no difficulty. Krishna can just, they're great sages, they're, you know, pretty much in touch with Krishna, so he could just reveal to them within their heart, and that could be the case. But in addition to that, I'd like to mention that this point, bring out this point too, that we're living in a hierarchically structured universe, according to the Bhagavatam. You know, the Bhagavatam presents a different picture of geographical picture of reality than modern science. So we're on this 14 planetary systems, and we're in in the middle. We're in the lowest of the seven upper planetary systems called Bhuloka, and that's described extensively in the fifth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And, the Earth as we know it is just a teeny little portion of Jambadweep. And Jambadweep is just a central island. And then it's surrounded by an ocean, which is surrounded by an island, which is surrounded by an ocean, which is surrounded by an island. I think it's seven of them like that. They're all inhabited. And it's described in the Bhagavatam that there are 400,000 humanoid or human-like species, different types of human beings, you could say, right, within the universe, right, and they're spread throughout the universe. And the human beings as we know them here on Earth are among the least powerful. You know, that's why Ravana, when he was awarded the benediction by Lord Brahma after he performed austerities like Aranyakasipu, he didn't even bother to ask not to be killed by a human being, because he was thinking, human beings are so, what do I have to be worried about these petty human beings for? So they didn't even bother to ask, right? So human beings, as we know them here on Earth, are among the least powerful. And a lot of these other human-like species, or humanoid species, they have varying degrees of mystic powers, right? In Bhuvar Loka, which is the planetary system just above Bhuloka, they're referred to as Upadevas, sub-demigods, and they live from 10,000 years on upwards. And they're born with mystic powers. There's a planet, Siddhaloka, which Prabhupada refers to in lectures he gave, where they're born with all eight mystic cities. And then above them, of course, is Swargaloka, where the demigods reside. They live sometimes up for hundreds of millions of years. Generally, Indra, I think it's 300 million years or something like that is his lifespan. And but what's here in this verse, it's talking about these great sages. Saints and sages. They reside primarily beyond Swargaloka, Swargaloka is still very materialistic. You know, Indra is always getting into trouble, as we've read so many times in the Bhagavatam, and there's wars between the Devas and the Asuras. But beyond Swargaloka, above Swargaloka, which is, you know, is Maharaloka. Then you have Janaloka, Tapaloka, Satyaloka, like that. That's seven. And that's how many there are. And they're basically sages. They're primarily interested in cultivating spiritual knowledge. You know, they're performing penances and austerities. They have lifespans that are way, and this is described in the second canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, by the way. They have lifespans that excel the lifespans of the demigods vastly. I mean, I can't remember the figures now, but I think it's like, you know, some of them live for like 1,500,000,000 years, something like that. I'd have to, maybe even longer. I can't remember. I didn't research it. I apologize. But they live, their lifespans are way beyond the demigods. So that's possibly who we're talking about here. I mean, you know, it doesn't say that these are like local sages. It just happened to be, you know, hanging out in some other part of India at the moment. No, they're coming from all over the universe. Well, that's the universe, what I just described. So these sages are coming in from these, you know, Maharaloka, possibly Tapaloka, Janaloka, like that. And so how do they know about it? Well, as I mentioned, you know, human beings are considered, as we know them, are considered among the least powerful, and a lot of these other species or human-like beings have these mystic powers. So they had these mystic powers. And these mystic powers include, this is kind of like a rundown of some of the more prominent mystic powers, and this is, it's described in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam that there are eight primary and about another 25 altogether, which are mystic powers, and they might be even, I think it says it might be even more, but these are the ones that come up most often throughout the Bhagavatam, and I tried to make a little list of them here. Mental communication and thought reading. That's a power that a lot of these higher human kind of beings have. So that would be enable them to possibly be aware. Unless they, I mean, once again, I'm not ruling out the possibility that they were directly tipped off by Krishna himself within their heart. But they, in addition to that, or aside from that, a lot of these beings have this power. You know, mental communication and thought reading. One example of that would be Vyasadeva. Would be you know, classic example was when he before he left, he told his mother that if you ever need me, just fix your mind upon me, and then I'll come right away. You know, so how does that work? Well, it worked because when she required him to help in producing some offspring to be the heir of the throne, she did exactly that. So, in other words, that means Vyasadeva had thought reading. He could understand that his mother was thinking about him, and he didn't have to mental communicate in return, but he just was able to be there, as he said he would, upon understanding that his mother was fixing her mind upon him. So another power that they have is they're able to see and hear at a great distance. I don't know the name, the Sanskrit name for the first two. But then another power that's quite prevalent among these more powerful human-like species is the ability to defy gravity, which is the Sanskrit word for that is lagima. And they can become lighter than the lightest. And also they can become heavier than the heaviest. And I don't know the Sanskrit word for that one. They can change size without disrupting the structure. See, you know, it's like, say, they could shrink their body down to the size of, you know, incredibly small. And that's called anima. And they have the opposite power as well, mahima, which they can expand their body. And this is demonstrated throughout the Krishna book. A lot of these demons that you know, Krishna encountered, they had this power, and also they had another power which will be coming up, which is that they could assume different forms. So they could assume different forms, they could assume that, you know, they could change the size of those forms as they liked. But if we're going back in order here, And here's another. This is an interesting one, that they can move objects without crossing intervening space. It's called Property City. And they can move objects without being impeded by gross physical objects. So this was this particular power is called Vihayasa, and it was demonstrated by Chitraleka, who was a friend of Usha. And everybody knows that as that pastime appears in the Krishna book. Usha was dreaming about, fantasizing about this. She actually was dreaming about a boy who she was very attracted to, and she, in the dream, she fell in love with him, and she was telling her friend about it. And anyway, Chitraleka was the daughter of the minister of her father, who was, what was his name? Bomasura? Bomasura. Yeah. Banasura. So anyway, so she said, I'll help you. And she was a mystic yogini, apparently. And she had this power. She was able to, you know, they figured out who she was dreaming about. And then she went to where he was. And then she just basically abducted him. And they traveled through the through gross physical objects. And what to speak of space, they traveled through gross physical objects. And then she plunked them right in the quarters where, you know, where Usha was, like that. So that was Vihayasa. And then there's one called Manojava, which is pretty much what Vyasadeva, I think, demonstrated. It means that the body can follow the mind. The person with this power just fixes their mind on where they want to be, and then they're there. So that's called Manojava. And Vasita, long-distance hypnotic control. Another one is called the power's invisibility, and it's called Antardhana. There was a Maharaj Antardhana, which we read about, I think, in the fourth canto of the Bhagavatam, or I can't remember which canto, but I can't remember the pastime very well, but there was this one Maharaj who had that name, because he had that power, Antardhana. As I mentioned, they can assume different forms, they can generate illusory bodily forms, and that was demonstrated among other places within that pastime with Dhruva Maharaj, where he was fighting against the Yakshas. At one point, you know, the Yakshas killed his brother, Utkala, and then he went to get revenge or retaliate. And then the Yakshas tried to kind of deter him or scare him by generating illusory bodily forms and all sorts of, and they were able to do that. Which brings out an interesting point, that these powers are possessed not by pious, more pious human-like beings. That's not a necessary qualification. You can have these mystic powers even and be very impious. The Asuras have all sorts of mystic powers, as do a lot of the more powerful humanoid races, predominantly influenced by the mode of ignorance. They have mystic powers as well. So it's not just that as you become more purified and pious, you can have these powers. There's ways to get them even without that. Let's just figure it in there. And finally, there's a mystic power by which these being, you can enter into somebody's body and control it. So in other words, the reason I got into this was that, just to make the point that these sages, they weren't necessarily dependent upon Krishna just within their heart, just kind of enlightening them. Although that was definite possibility, they had mystic powers. They could, you know, understand what was going on and get there at will. So one point that came to my mind upon when I was, you know, kind of reflecting upon this overall situation was, because I try to, you know, when I prepare the class and when I think about these types of things, what's a lesson for us? You know, what's something that we can, you know, benefit by understanding as a result of, you know, this information, was that, you know, these great elevated devotees, sages, you know, you can't pull the wool over their eyes. And there was immediately the thought that came to my mind when I was reading this is, well, you know, just like, you know, they're able to know so much without being directly informed. And I, for some reason, my mind went to the analogy of our situation in relation to our spiritual master and the predecessor acharyas and Krishna, and that you know, just like these sages, you know, they knew. Nobody sent them a telegram or, you know, use their cell phone to contact him, or et cetera, you know. But they knew. So in the same way, Krishna and the spiritual master know. And, you know, they know what we're doing, how we're performing, and what we're even, what to speak of how we're performing, what we're even thinking. So we have to, you know, it's a good idea to remember that, be aware of that, and, you know, try to make the effort to be sincere about following. This is a quote from a lecture Prabhupada gave in Hawaii in 1974, where he talks about this point. So he's talking about deity worship. He says, so therefore the deity worship is there. Along with the deity worship, we should always pray, Krishna kindly save me from the pitfalls of Maya. He'll do it. Now here it comes. This is the point. He says, but if we want to cheat Krishna and cheat Guru, then you'll be cheated. That's all. The Guru will not be cheated. Neither Krishna will be cheated. You'll be cheated. That's all. So if you want to be cheated, then do whatever you like and prolong your term of repetition of birth and death. And if you want to stop it, then tapasya, brahmacharya, you know, you have to perform tapasya. So, it's a good point to remember that we might be thinking, well, I could be slack in my sadhana, I can cut corners, who's going to know? And you might get away with it. On a material level, gross material level, you do get away with it sometimes. You know, you can miss a lot of the program and nobody knows or nobody says anything. But it's kind of like we're cutting our own throat because Krishna knows, Guru knows, and Krishna knows. And whatever, you know, we're doing is being evaluated and responded to at some level. And really it's only ourselves that we're fooling, cheating, and hurting. So that's a good point to remember. On a more positive note, I was thinking about, I was listening to this lecture that Prabhupada gave about, he was talking about, how are we doing for time there? 10 past? 8 or 9? Okay. Yeah, so on a more positive note, I was listening to this lecture Prabhupada was giving on the Chaitanya Charitamrita back in 1967 in San Francisco. And it was the section about Lord Chaitanya was traveling, and he was, as he did from the, you know, after he took sannyas, he made his headquarters in Jagannath Puri, and then for 6 years he traveled, and one of his trips was to Vrindavan. So I think this was his first trip to Vrindavan, actually. And on the way, he passed through Varanasi, which was the capital, you could say, or the, you know, the headquarters of the Mayavadi sannyasis, different philosophical schools of thoughts. I forget the names of them, but and probably just as well. But there was different, and they were all criticizing him. You know, he just maybe was there for a few days, and they were criticizing. And Lord Chaitanya made note of that, but he didn't want to. You know, he said it's described in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. He just laughed, laughed in himself, you know. And then he went on to Vrindavan, and he kind of decided he was going to deal with it on his way back, which he did. So after he was on his way back from Vrindavan, he stopped in Varanasi, and he stayed at the home of Chandrasekhar Acharya, who was not an Acharya. He was actually, but he was a devotee, but that's just his name. He wasn't an Acharya. He was actually a Kayasta. And which was considered in those days as practically speaking like a sudra. But he stayed at his home for 2 months. And I read in one of Prabhupada's purports that at that time, if you aside from Brahmins, all the other castes, even the Kshatriyas and the Vaishyas, were considered sudras. There was Brahmins and non-Brahmins. That was basically how it worked at that time. And sannyasis, there was an injunction of some sort that sannyasis should stay at the home of Brahmins because Brahmins worship Shalagram Shila, and then they could, you know, get prasadam and like that. So it was actually, Lord Chaitanya was doing something a little bit unconventional or radical, but he's the Supreme Personality of God, that he's completely independent. He doesn't have to. He had a higher purpose to fulfill. So anyway, he stayed with Chandrasekhar. And during that time, Sanatan Goswami came, and he instructed Sanatan Goswami for 2 months. And that's how we got the Hari Bhakti Vilas, actually. That was, he gave him all the instructions required for Sanatan Goswami to produce that book. So during that time, though, what was happening, as was happened previously, the Mayavadi sannyasis in Benares were criticizing Lord Chaitanya. And the two devotees that were there, Chandrasekhar and Tapan Mishra, they were both Kanishtha Adhikaris. They weren't advanced devotees. They were devotees, staunch, but they didn't know the. They weren't conversant enough in the Shastras to be able to enter into debate with these Mayavadi sannyasis and, what to speak of, defeat them. So they were becoming very disturbed. And they actually went to Lord Chaitanya at some point. I don't know if they said they were going to commit suicide. They threatened to commit suicide if they something. They just expressed to him how disturbed they were by the whole situation. They couldn't. It was becoming intolerable for them. What was intolerable for them, and they just couldn't take it anymore. And like that. And as I mentioned, Lord Chaitanya, it's just mentioned in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that he had already decided he was going to deal with this situation on his way back. So by his arrangement, I would say, you know, an arrangement of the internal potency, a Brahmin happened to come, and that's just right around that time there, and he invited Lord Chaitanya to take lunch with all the sannyasis. He had invited all the sannyasis, the Mayavadi sannyasis in Benares, to his home to have lunch. And he wanted Lord Chaitanya to join. And he already knew that Lord Chaitanya didn't associate with the Mayavadi sannyasis, but he just begged him for his mercy, that, you know, please be merciful to me and make an exception. And Lord Chaitanya agreed, which was, you know, unusual, but he did. And then when Lord Chaitanya got there, he he sat with a, you know, everybody in India, people wear... don't wear shoes a lot of times, and they're walking around, and the feet get dirty. So they have a place to wash your feet on the just outside the house before you come in. And so Lord Chaitanya, you know, came and he cleaned his feet, and then he sat down in that place, and then which is, you know, considered muchi, not a clean place. So Prakasananda Saraswati, who is the leader of the Mayavadi sannyasis, he could immediately see that, you know, this is. Okay, this is the fellow that we've been criticizing, but just from his appearance, he could understand this is no ordinary person. I mean, he can immediately, just from the visual appearance of Lord Chaitanya, he was able to appreciate that, wait, this is not some just ordinary person. Let's figure out what's going on here. So he said, you know, he asked him to come and sit with the rest of them. And anyway, I'm going to stop there because it's quarter past eight. I'm running out of time. To be continued. It's like one of these. We'll keep, leave everybody in suspense. You could read the Adi Lila chapter 7 if you want to know the rest of the text. I got up to about text 60 there. But does anybody have any questions or comments? Okay. You got a little extra Krishna Katha there at no extra charge. Here comes the mic. Yeah, I probably should have stopped right at 10 past. I didn't want to stop on such a heavy note, though.
First of all, before I even begin my comment, my first comment would be somebody should be assigned to doing this so that devotees having they're here and also abroad or outside should not be waiting for the speaking to go on. Everybody has to do things with their time, and therefore we have to value everyone else's time. So if somebody wants to volunteer to do that on a regular basis, who's always coming, but Bhakta Brad, would you like to? Because you're always in charge of the microphone and the sign. Or is that a bit much more than you? It's okay? Yeah, as long as it gets there and somebody puts it back from where it goes, it has to be also put back by the same person who places it there. Okay. Thank you very much, Manji. Just one point in regarding the... there was another point in regard to Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu when Mayavad Sajjasis saw him sitting in a dirty place and so forth. But there was another factor which wowed them, and that was the radiation of light. He was manifesting. They said, is this Narayan or what? Is this the Supreme Lord? Who's radiating all... And look, he's sitting in the dirty place. So he obviously is unaffected by this dirty place because he's radiating such light. That's all I wanted to say. If anyone wants to take it from there, that's fine. The other thing is this is one cautionary note. It may sound very, very attractive and fascinating and glorious to be able to acquire many of these mystical powers that you were mentioning. First thing is this, is that it is very dangerous to consciously and determinedly or directly try to acquire them. And that is because there is the chance of not only having them, as many of the demons have them, but they misuse them. And they misuse them in such a way as to harm other human beings who should not be harmed. For example, in the Ramayana, we find that these demons, they were killing Brahmins. That was their sport. That was their fun, and then they would eat the food because they were cannibals as well. So, therefore, they use their powers to harm or hurt or to expedite whatever they wanted. It was not in the line of depending upon Krishna, getting the okay from Krishna, and then moving ahead like that. So, devotees who are very advanced, by the way, like we see Hanuman and so forth, they don't have to acquire, they don't do practices, techniques to become very powerful, to get those powers that you mentioned, anima and mahima and levitation and all of these things. They come quite naturally and automatically. Krishna gives them as a gift. It's a it's in other words, as a person is able to use those powers in the service of the Lord, as Hanuman did. He flew from the mainland to Lanka in order to rescue Sita. That was just one example. So devotees who love Krishna and want to serve Krishna and want to do Krishna's will only use them for the purposes of doing exactly that. If we have false ego, if we have material desire, we should wish to not have such powers. Because by all chance, because we want to be God, we want to be high, we want to be great, we want people to look up to us, to honor us, the chance will be that we will misuse them. If not for just to be known as an important celebrity or a great personality. This is also betokens pride. False pride. A kind of pride that actually pushes a devotee down instead of raising him to a higher level. Why does it do that? Because you begin to think you're so superior to so many other beings. I can do this, I can do that, nobody else can do it. I'm above them, and therefore don't. And then what happens is in the course, Krishna can take those powers away. That's the first thing. And second of all, if we misuse them, then we receive a very powerful and terrible karmic reaction, which can actually, because you're using power, you get the power on you, and you have to suffer for that. So that's all I wanted to say. It's not something to be desirable. Let Krishna do the needful, and if he wants us to have them, if they can be used for some benevolent or useful purpose, fine. But let Krishna be the decider of that. We can't decide, especially if we still have a little false ego there, we may misuse it. But if Krishna says, yes, use that now, then we can do that because it's his desire that we do it. That's safe and it's secure and it's laudable, it's praiseworthy. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.